Okay, these are the last questions for this retreat. Maybe. The future is uncertain. So, here we go. Are you sitting comfortably? Dear Ajahn Brahmawamsa, thank you for showing us the way to Nibbana. Although it is not easy, of course it's easy. You make it hard. There's an old story about this. This man went up to this Japanese monk, full of faith, and he bowed to this Japanese monk. And the Japanese monk said, "What are you bowing to me for?" And he said, "Oh, you monks, you give up so much. You're so pure. You have to endure such hardships." The monk said, "Endure hardships? Is that why you're bowing to me?" He said, "Oh, yes." "Oh," said the monk. So he got down on his haunches and he bowed to the layperson. "You experience much more hardships than I do." No, life is easy when you let go. You have to worry, you have to think, you have to plan, you have to get guilty, you have to have grief, you have to get angry. Oh, that's really hard work. So it's great being a monk. You don't have to get angry, you don't have to worry about things, you don't have to have fear, you don't have to have all these rotten things you have to think about. So really, I should be bowing to you. Oh, it must be so hard not being a monk. So, it is easy. This is the easy life. Although it is not easy, but you make the way full of fun, although some still show sour faces. Yeah, I know, I've been watching all your sour faces all through it, but I expect to have really sour faces tomorrow. When we have to leave, oh no. I expect the tears to flow. Oh, I don't want to go. Oh, I don't want to go. Anyway, maybe we will not make it to Nibbana this time. Who knows? But at least we now know the way and we will try our best. Oh, don't try. You will not try your best. You will do your best and not try to get there. Promise. Wish you all the best. Now, untried. Very good. And a smooth passage to Nibbana with metta, your disciples, from Terengganu. Very good. Okay, the next question. This is really good. These aren't questions. This is like fan mail. Our dearest Venerable Ajahn Brahm, that sounds like attachment. What's it say next? Will you run away and marry me? No? No, they don't say things like that. That happened, though, to one of the monks some years ago. None of the monks you know here, but this monk used to say, it's actually, some of you know, Ajahn Weerodhammo in New Zealand a long time ago. He was teaching a retreat, and someone left him a note there after about the 8th, 9th day of the retreat. So he picked it up and read it out. Dear Ajahn, I love you very much. Please run away and marry me. That's what it said. But anyway, I don't think I've got those in here, I hope. Dear Ajahn Vajra Brahm, you are the most funniest, adorable, loving, respected, and honourable teacher with all our hearts. We walk the path as shown to us with sincerity, and we bliss out, finally disappear in Nibbana, reach the shore, sitting on top of the coconut tree. No, it's not the top of the coconut tree. The bottom of the coconut tree. And have a cup of tea. With Anjali and deepest gratitude, signed your humbly little student. Very nice. So these are the questions I really like. Why didn't you write those questions at the beginning? Okay. Another thing. Wear the info. Put on your sweaters. It's going to be a cold night with a temperature dropping to 9 degrees. Rain to continue till tomorrow, but with slightly warmer climate of 13 to 20 degrees. Sunday's weather is cloudy, a nice 15 to 23 degrees centigrade. But that's the weather forecast for Samsara. The weather info for Nibbana is everything is just right. It's not too cold, not too hot. It's just a nice 24 degrees in Nirvana today, and the same tomorrow and for a whole eternity. The weather forecast from Nirvana. Okay, next question. Ajahn Brahm, you know that my advice for dealing with the weather, if it's really a cold day, you develop a warm heart. And if it's a hot day, you develop a cool mind. And so that way, when it's hot outside, you're cool inside. When it's cold outside, you're warm and kind. And that way, you'll always balance the vicissitudes of the weather with the wisdom of your mind. Ajahn Brahm, as one loses all body consciousness, but not the other senses, and one gets a full realization of the three characteristics of existence, would you call it the first jhana? It's when you lose all body consciousness, in other words, your body disappears. It's not the first jhana yet. It's called the absence of the five hindrances. It's sometimes you call that, in the commentaries, they call it upachara samadhi, the neighborhood concentration. You're very close to jhana, but not quite in. You're actually on the doorstep. But it's always, they say, and it's always important to know, that it's the upachara samadhi, on the neighborhood to jhanas, that's where you get the great big insights. That's where enlightenment happens. But what few people say, which you understand through experience, is that you're on the neighborhood before you go into the jhana, but you're also on the neighborhood as you go out. You go over the doormat as you go into your house, but you also go over it on your way out. And the point is, it's on the way out where you linger the longest, where you're more sure of actually where you are. Which is why that sure it is possible to get that enlightenment just before jhana, but it's very unlikely. It's the after one. That's where you stay in that upachara, where the five hindrances are not there for long periods of time. So the two upachara samadhis, the neighborhood concentrations they call it, the one before you get into jhana is not anywhere near as useful, as powerful as the one on the way out from jhana. So that's the one to develop, the one on the way out. And if you really get wisdom on the way out, you are on the way out. On the way out from samsara. So it's when your consciousness disappears, you can't call that first jhana. First jhana is when everything is still. And even ideas of anicca, dukkha, anatta, they can't come up in that state. Nothing can arise. Everything is still. So still and so peaceful. And there's one nice thing about the jhanas. You cannot feel the cold or the heat. You are impervious to the weather of the world. So if you're afraid of the low temperatures this evening, get into jhana tonight and you won't know a thing. So easy, stop messing around, my goodness. Any questions about that? Comments? Okay, here we go. The next question. Tremendous amount of joy. Tremendous amount of happiness and tremendous amount of gratitude to the Buddha and to you, Ajahn Brahm. That's tremendous. Knowing that I'm on the path, this is the right path and there is no turning back. Thank you. Please kindly not to read out the name, which is with great gratitude, respect and metta. The secret person. Dear Ajahn Brahm, this is really nice, not questions, this is fan mail. You ever notice that the less self you've got left, the more praise you have? The more selfless you are, the more the people respect you. Don't know what they're respecting. They're respecting the no self when you disappear. Thank you so much for a wonderful retreat. Your Dharma talks sell. Is that right? Sell? I'm missing a marketing opportunity here. They're giving these away for free. My goodness. It is captivating, and you have explained the essence of the Dharma really clearly to me. May you be well and happy. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Is this all the same writing? Yeah. Just like my writing. Dear Ajahn Brahm, You said one can meditate even when one is sick. Because when one is sick, one's mind is not sick. What if one's mind is sick? E.g., when one is in depression, can one meditate? Oh, yeah, of course. Now, P.S. also advised a spiritual way to treat depression. Is depression an illness of your mind? Can the mind be sick? A crazy jhana, whatever it is. Okay, depression. Sometimes it's like depression. You get yourself in a hole of depression. Just a lot of negativity and it builds up. And once you get into depression, the problem is you get depressed about being depressed. I don't want to be depressed. It's not nice being depressed. And of course you just dig yourself in deeper into the hole. So, just like in that story in the book about the anger-eating demon, that's a great story. You can apply that to many, many aspects of your meditation. The anger-eating demon, get out of here, you don't belong. And the demon gets worse. You say, welcome, demon, welcome, thank you for coming to visit me. And the demon gets smaller and smaller. Until you give it enough welcome, it vanishes completely away. So if you get boredom in your meditation, welcome, boredom, thank you so much for coming to visit me. It's really interesting being bored. Makes a change from being euphoric. So, whatever else happens in your meditation, you get restless. Welcome, restlessness. Thank you for coming to visit me. So you welcome everything in your meditation. As I told one person in the interviews, I was taught by Ajahn Chah, whatever comes into your day, into your practice, you always call it teacher. So when a mosquito comes and it bothers you, it's called Ajahn Mosquito. Who's come to teach you a lesson in patience, in letting go, in keeping things in perspective. That little mosquito, it only takes a tiny bit of your blood, an infinitesimal portion. Are you so stingy you can't share a little bit of your blood and give some dana to this mosquito? And sure, it irritates, but it's only a tiny bit of irritation. And sometimes you think, wow, I bet all these other people, they've got the insect repellent on. Now you should take a leaf out of the Mahayana doctrine. You should be a bodhisattva. You should be the one who doesn't take mosquito repellent. And you should be the one who sits by the door saying, mosquitoes, take me. Bite me so you don't disturb all those other meditators so they can get into jhana. As for me, I'm hopeless, take me. So that way, you are letting go. And what point is here that you call those insects, you call them Ajahn, mosquito. Because they're teaching you something. They're teaching you patience. They're teaching you letting go. They're teaching you being able to be at peace with the irritating. That's why they're teachers. It's very easy to actually have fun. That's why you don't learn so much from the fun things of life. But you sure learn a lot from what's irritating. When it doesn't go according to plan, and when you can't control it, especially the mosquitoes. When you finish here, you can swat those mosquitoes, those of you who don't keep the five precepts. But here, you can't swat any mosquitoes. Why? Because the monks are watching you. So you can't do that. So you can't control these mosquitoes. You just have to let them go. Let it be. And you see that, okay, it's a little irritation, but it doesn't last that long. A few seconds, that's all. Maybe a minute or two, and it's all gone. What's the big deal? You learn how to endure the unpleasant. Just like in meditation, sometimes it's unpleasant, but if you learn how to endure it, it doesn't last all that long. If you go scratching those mosquito bites, then it lasts much longer. Or if you try flicking them off. I used to do that when I was a young monk. These mosquitoes would bite you, rotten mosquito, you flick them off. You wouldn't kill them, just flick them off. You know what they would do? They'd fly up and they'd land again, another part, and bite you again. So you get two bites for the price of one. So that's really, really silly. So then I decided, okay, mosquitoes, you can just bite once, get it over and done with, and finish with it. But then I found some of these mosquitoes. You know what they would do? You'd leave them there, you'd just watch them, come on, bite, and have some of my blood, out of compassion and kindness. Mosquitoes, I love you. You'd be so kind and gentle to them. And so the mosquitoes will put their little nose down in one place. Ooh, that little... No, it's not stung, but you know, it irritates a bit. And then they'd take their nose out, they'd take a few steps and do another exploratory drill. They were taking advantage of my loving kindness, the blooming mosquitoes. Now, they are the great teachers, the ones who take advantage of you. But they teach you extra patience, so they were the super teachers. So whatever it is, so like sickness is the same, or depression. It's adjunct depression, come to teach you something. So when you call it adjunct depression, you value the experience. You don't think that this is something to get rid of as soon as possible, something which is hopeless, something which is a blight on your life. Everything gets welcomed. So number one, you don't get depressed about being depressed. You learn in life to welcome all experiences. The good ones are fun, and the rotten ones are fertilizer. The dung ones, the smelly ones, the sticky, awful ones, they're the fertilizer for your wisdom and compassion. So all things become welcomed. In the same way when you're meditating. I mentioned this in passing, maybe in the interviews, but it's a great teaching. My first meditation teacher was brilliant in many ways. He told me, he said, there's no such thing as a bad meditation. What do you mean, no such thing as a bad meditation? He said, no such thing as a bad meditation. All meditation is good. Those restless ones, that's where you learn. Those crazy ones, that's where you discover great truths, where you can learn endurance and patience. All the meditations are worthwhile. Not one is wasted. The ones which are fun, that's where you just get the paycheck. The ones where it's hard work, that's where you have to do the job, the toil. But they're all really useful. And you don't get those good meditations without doing the hard work. All those hard meditations, that's what causes the good ones. So, all meditations are worthwhile. There's no such thing as a bad one. So when you understand that, you start to accept life. There's no such thing as bad weather. The weather's not evil. We call it bad, as if the weather sort of has got this malicious intent to make it difficult for all our visitors from Malaysia and Singapore, make it really extra cold for you. We're going to teach you a lesson. No, the weather is not malicious. So why do you call it bad weather? Why do you call it good weather? Is the weather some type of saint which is looking, oh, what should we do today? Let's make it nice and sunny to make people happy. It doesn't do that. It hasn't got an intention. So why do we call the weather good or bad? The weather's just weather, that's all. So all weather is good. And all of your experiences are good. Which is why even today, I've told you this before, when you come into the interviews and somehow had a terrible day today, I said, good. What are you talking about? Didn't you hear me? I said, I had a terrible day today. Couldn't do anything. I said, good, very good. Because all your experience is good. And when you learn how to welcome everything in life, how can you get depressed? You can welcome depression. Depression, come in. The door of my heart is open to all of life, no matter what it is. And when you learn how to welcome life, all of life, not just the stuff you like, you're halfway to enlightenment. No craving, no desires. So I tell people who are depressed, don't try and get rid of depression. That just makes it worse. Accept depression. Make peace with it. If you make peace with depression, after a while it disappears. Much of depression, you could probably have understood some of this with the insight from meditation. Once your mindfulness, or rather, once you start to develop more peace in your life, you start to go still, you don't do so much, you find you've got more energy in your mind. Most people have told me that when they first came, the first few days, they were nodding, they were very sleepy. But now you can meditate, and actually you're quite bright. You're much brighter than when you started. Why? It's because the energy hasn't been going on into the doer. You haven't been managing things. You haven't been needing to think what you're going to do and go on the computer and do all of this and do all of that. because of that, the energy's gone into the mind. You're brighter, you're more awake, you're more alert. So what happens? Can you get depressed when you've got energy in the mind? You find that you're much further from depression now than you were when you started. One of the reasons is the mind has energy. Can see the beauty in things, can accept things. But when the mind loses its energy, it gets very dull. And the bright green of the grass is lost and looks like a dull green. Or like now, because there's not much light out there, you can hardly see the colours at all. All the colour, the vibrancy, the texture of life is washed out when the mind is dull. And sometimes the nice people come around you when you're depressed. You just can't value them, you can't see them, you can't feel anything. There's no joy, there's no oomph in life anymore. There's nothing wrong with life. It's the mind is dull. And you can get so dull that you can't see anything worth living for. That's where you get really depressed. And if you struggle to get out of it, the little energy you have is just taken away by the struggle. And the mind still is in that darkness. That's why the best way, I say, my understanding of the mind, if you're really depressed, is to leave it alone, be at peace with it, welcome it. Endure it for a while. And if you endure it, you can actually give that hope that all things will pass, it's a temporary thing. You know it's going to pass, so just enjoy it, be at peace with it, allow it to be. Give it metta. And then because of that, you're given the opportunity for your energy, the little you have, to flow into the mind. And the mind brightens up, and with it so does the world. You start to appreciate the little things in life more. Your friends, your little enjoyments, a cup of tea tastes sweeter. The food tastes more delicious. As you lift the mind out of depression by allowing energy to go into the mind. So, that's a meditator's answer to the problem of depression. I think there's more depression around these days because people do so much. And when things go wrong, they struggle even more hard. And that means that they don't have any energy left at all. So, I'm going to write that out and get a PhD for depression therapy or something. If I don't get a PhD, I'll get very depressed. Do that, Jan. Can you give that quote that goes something like, "Oh, what bliss, there is no happiness in the world." Where does that come from in the Tripitaka? I actually don't know where it comes from in the Tripitaka. I know that there was a quote under this saying, under this statue in Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery. I'm not sure actually where the origin of that comes from. It's an interesting question. But I know the quote is, "Oh, what joy to know there's no happiness in the world." And the meaning of it is that when you know there's no happiness, no permanent happiness in the world, you stop seeking for it. You stop demanding it. And when you don't demand and seek that happiness in the world, you let go. You're at peace with things. Most people think if they try hard enough, they can make this world into a happy place. All you people who have been married, learn from this experience and next time get it right. Choose the right girl, the beautiful one, and you'll be happy ever after. Or choose a good guy next time. This is what we think the next time we'll get it right. We think that there is our perfect person in the world, our soulmate, who we can live happy ever after with forevermore. It's just we haven't found them yet. Remember years ago this lady came along and she said, "Oh, I know he's out there somewhere." Said, "Come off it, you're almost 60 now." She was still looking, still romantic, it's crazy lady. We always think that happiness is out there somewhere in the world. There's the perfect job, the perfect place. But when? When we know that, there's no happiness to be found in the world. You know, if you get married, this is the amount of happiness you get, this is the amount of suffering you get. Look at other people who have been married. And you think that your marriage is special and somehow different? Of course it ain't. It's the same as everybody else's. So it's obvious. This is, before you get married, do some research, first of all. Go and check every other marriage you know. That might give you second thoughts. Or before you go get born again. Look at what life is. But you think, this time I'll get it right. This time I'll do it proper. This time I'll be rich, I'll be successful because I learnt my lessons. No, you make the same mistakes over and over again. So the point is, when you know there's no happiness in the world, you stop seeking for happiness. You stop craving. And you just let go. And you accept the world as it is. You accept your husband as they are, your wife as they are. Instead of trying to get the perfect child, you get just the ordinary child. Just like your one. The one who drives you crazy. Like everybody else's child. You make peace with the world. You're becoming realistic. And with that, you don't seek for this silly happiness in the world. And when you let go, then you find the happiness. Joy at last. To know I don't need to strive to make things work. I don't need to strive so hard to get rich, because rich is happiness. You realize that's not true. I don't need to strive so hard to make sure my relationship works. No, that's not true. It never works. It's out of control. I don't need to strive so hard to get rid of my cancer. If you get rid of the cancer, it's just the same. So, happiness at last. So now I don't have to do anything. Isn't that great? Just really relax. After all. The simile I say of being in the aircraft going to Ranganu. You might strive to try and get to the front of the aircraft, thinking that that's the way to get there quickly. That's the way to happiness. And look at all the people in the back of the aircraft, the lazy scallywags. They don't put any effort. They should try harder, you think. The way in the front of the aircraft or the back of the aircraft, you get there at the same time. So, why not just let go? Stop seeking for that happiness in the world which you'll never find. When you stop seeking, you let go. You're at peace. Ah, that's happiness. Joy at last. To know there's no happiness in the world. There's nothing wrong with me. For all of you who've had failed relationships. For all of you who have failed parents. For all of you who are failing in life. For all of you who are failing in meditation. Oh, wonderful. Joy at last. To know there's no jhana in the world. So I'm striving for something which doesn't exist. Oh, now you can really relax and take it easy for the rest of the retreat. Then you get jhana. I understand? Yeah, good. Dear Ajahn, what is the best sitting posture for meditation? Does the posture affect the progress of meditation? What is the next best sitting posture besides a full lotus posture used and recommended by the Buddha? Please help, because I just can't sit for long in a cross-legged posture. The best posture is the one you're in now, whatever that is. There is no magic posture. You don't have to sit cross-legged in full lotus. You can get enlightened without that. And I know a lot of people who go cross-legged in full lotus and have to have knee operations the week afterwards because they just can't stand it. And I did this from personal experience to understand that time I told you when I was having the fever and I got into deep net meditation while I was sick. One of the things I noticed when I came out of that deep meditation, I looked at my posture. And I was laying on a bed, my arms were one way, the legs were the other way, it's all over the place. I've never seen a posture like that in any book. I should have taken a photograph of it and said, this is the posture which leads to deep meditation. So you could put one leg over here and one leg over there, and it'd be the Ajahn Brahm posture, whatever you call it, instead of the cross-legged lotus posture. It's not the lotus posture, like the weed posture, I don't know what it's called. But the point was, I could get in that posture and get into deep meditation. And that proved to me, look, this posture business is nothing magical about your posture. The whole point of the posture is so you can sit down and give some comfort to the body so the body can disappear. So you can just get into deep meditation. Which is why people can sit in chairs. Why they can have these cushions or stools or whatever else you've got. Maybe one day someone will develop the ultimate meditation cushion. So you just press the button and it moves this way and that way and the front goes back. I'm sure you can do that. And even a cushion, you just press the button, you have a cup of tea there as well. And press another button, a little fan comes out if it's too cold and blows cold air at you. Another one which gets hot air comes out. You can get one of these state-of-the-art meditation cushions. You can set it and make a fortune. But the point is, it doesn't matter what your posture is. So you don't have to sit cross-legged. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Sometimes you get some of your best meditations in the toilet. You can sit down there, and it's nice and quiet. We call that, as one of the monks said, you might have heard this word before, engaged Buddhism. Yes, okay. Some of you got that joke. You've heard engaged Buddhism before. That's a title people say that Buddhists should get out there in the world and do things. But here we call it engaged Buddhism, being in the toilet with the engaged sign outside. Every night for the whole duration of this retreat, I have experienced violent dreams in the form of bloodshed, physical trauma, sometimes to those I know, and some dreams involving strangers, children being murdered, my cat being traumatized, my sister in a violent scene, terrorism, and even you, Ajahn Brahm, presiding at a funeral sacrifice, a funeral scene or service. While not being scared by them, I do wonder, what is the significance, if any, of these recurrent dreams every night for the past nights? Please advise, thank you. Okay. Actually, I've noticed a couple of people are missing from my retreat. Where are they gone? Maybe we find some dead bodies. After the retreat is gone, we start with the cleanup. All that really is just sometimes people get so bored meditating all day, watching the breath, and your brain rebels at night. Okay, let's have some interesting excitement. Just like watching the TV. Why do people like to watch these violent movies, which are really gory? You know that you don't watch TV, but once, when I went to visit my mother years and years and years ago, that was the first time. I was staying with her my mother and myself. In the evening, she watched the TV, so I decided to watch some with her. And I saw this half an hour detective program, and I hadn't seen the TV for years, and I couldn't believe it. In the space of 30 minutes, there was about 8 or 9 murders. That's what it was. Just people, getting some guns and shooting each other. All the rest of the action was just fill, to get to the gory parts. And people love that sort of stuff. Bang, bang, people getting murdered or tortured or stuff like that. So, it's because of that, that's what we see as excitement in the world. That's what we see as a way of letting loose, of entertaining ourselves. So it's just probably the mind entertaining itself in the evening, that's all. When you're dreaming, that's all. So to stop all of that business, if you want to, do some loving kindness before you go to bed. May all beings be happy and well. May all beings be free of suffering. So when you go to loving kindness, that's what you get sort of in the sleep. But it could also be because you are fed up with me. Ajahn Brahm teaching us to let go. I want to strangle that Ajahn Brahm. But don't worry, it's only a dream. I'll lock my door tonight. Yeah. There we go. By the way, I don't have nightmares. Cheese and chocolate, that's what's doing it to you. So if you're really bored and you really want to have a good dream tonight, take lots of cheese and chocolate. And then you see the most violent R-rated movie in your dreams you've ever seen. People might get into that. Anyway, one way you can make use of that, though, is when you wake up, write it all down, send it to the TV for a script, and the Buddhist Society of WA gets 10%. Again. Okay, here we go again. Dhruvajan Brahman said, this is a scenario. Oh, this is, what's this? Okay. This is a scenario. I am young. I have made a lot of money, enough of my whole life. I spend my money for sensual pleasures upon myself, moderately and according to the precepts. With my money, I take good care of my parents, my family, my workers, and my servants. Yeah. I am trying my best to be generous to everybody. Try not to be stingy. I used to be. I donate to charity. I do dana to the Sangha. I began to learn the Dharma Sutra. I meditate once or twice almost every day. I even go to meditation retreats, even though I never believe I would ever found jhana there. I am contented in life. I now live life taking the five precepts. I know by following the Buddha's teaching I will find happiness. I don't expect to go to nirvana this life, but neither do I think I will go to the state of world in the next rebirth. This is how I look at my life, and I'm enjoying every moment of it. No harm to others. Now, Ajahn, even if there are dukkhas everywhere, I feel for me most of the time it is happiness in life. Please comment on my kind of Buddhist life. Okay. Now, sometimes when things go well in life, you know, you're reasonably wealthy, you're young, you're fit, and life is going well, you do a bit of dana here, you've got a nice family, everything's going well. Your call, you're doing what Visakha called eating old food. Because Visakha, one of the chief disciples of the Buddha, the chief lay disciple of the Buddha, she was not only a good disciple, she was incredibly smart. And so when she got married to this scallywag called Migara, who didn't like monks? They should get a proper job. They're just scroungers. Why should we give them food? What work do they do? So he forbade his wife from giving dana. And so she couldn't argue with her husband in those days, but instead she just went around telling her friends, oh, in our family we only eat old food. In our family we only eat old food. When her husband heard about that, he scolded her. Wife, what do you mean we eat only old food? I send the servants to the market every morning. We get fresh vegetables, fresh everything. What do you mean we only eat old food? And she said, we are rich, we are healthy, we are content because of all the past karma we've done in previous lives. We're just eating the old karma. We're not making any new karma. That's what I mean. We're only eating old food. And the way she said it must have really hit the point, because her husband understood. And from that time on, not only did he permit her and gave dana himself to the monks and nuns, but he called her his mother in the Dharma. He called his wife mother. And that's why one of the names for Visakha was Migara Mata, the mother of Migara, the mother of her husband, because she taught him Dharma. So, if that's happening to you, you're having a good life, be careful. It might be you're just eating the old good karma. So make sure you make some good karma in this life. You don't use it just for your sensory pleasures. To make sure that the money, the health you have, you make use of to the very, very best of your abilities. Very often they say that a person gets the gift of wealth in this life because they've been charitable in their last life. It's as if that karma knows who to give the money to. Those people know how to use it. If you use it well in your next life, you get given some more in the life after. But if you don't use it well, you just use it for stinginess, buying yourself good things, not looking after others, then you realize, oh, that person, they don't know how to use money. So you don't get much the next time. So, but making good karma is not just giving donations. Making good karma is also being kind and compassionate to others, doing service for the community. And it's also keeping precepts. So you keep those precepts. You get inspired. Say, I've got this wonderful life. I've got the freedom which my wealth gives me. I can keep these precepts. I don't need to make any compromises. I can pay all my taxes. I can give charity, even to the government. And now I've got this time, this health, instead of wasting it just jetting around all over the world, I can actually go to as many retreats as possible, learn meditation to support the monasteries or whatever. And I'm going to use my time, my energy, my good health to the max. And that's a person who does this because they know their freedom from suffering is only temporary. Because sometimes I've seen that with very wealthy people. Sometimes things go wrong. The stock market crashes. Your investments are lost. Someone cheats you from your business. Your wife is unfaithful. Your children get into trouble. You get cancers. And sometimes these very, very wealthy people living a great lifestyle suddenly, whoosh, go down. It's all impermanent. The wealth, the happiness of the world. But if you've got the wealth and happiness inside of your good karma, that stock market, the karma stock market, never crashes. It always goes up, 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 up. So make sure you invest where you get maximum returns. In meditation retreats. So that's what I would do. Any questions about that? Now, one of our monks, I don't mind telling about him again. There's many monks like this. Couple of very wealthy families. And this is a monk who spent a year with us. He's gone back to Thailand now, staying with Ajahn Yanadhamma. He is a son of, what's his name again? Ananda Krishnan. The guy who owns one of the Twin Towers in KL. The richest man in Malaysia. So I saw in a Penang paper, I think, at that time, a couple of years ago, it was worth about 8 or 9 billion US. And he's only got one son. Now, if you were the son of a multi-billionaire, do you think you need to go to have a job? Do you need to think you have to go looking around for pretty girls? Do you think you have to work and get up early in the morning? And he's given all that up to become a monk. Now, that's a smart man. So if you really have got all that good karma, you're healthy, you're wealthy, good life, and go be a monk. Or be a nun. That's what I suggest. Any questions about that? Sometimes people say, oh, I can't be a monk, I can't be a nun, because I've got to work hard to feed my family, I've got to look after my parents, or I'm too sick, I'm too old. If you're none of those things, great. Go for the ultimate good karma. Yeah. Say? Edinburgh, yeah. That's him, yeah. Really nice guy. Dear Ajahn Brahm, this afternoon while sitting in a corridor staring out a window at the bleak landscape contemplating Anatta, not far away a Dharma sister also sits staring blankly out of a window contemplating who knows. That's a great contemplation. Who knows? What is it which knows? Who knows? That's like Ajahn Chah's question, why? Who knows? Who does know then? Who's listening to this talk? So whoever's doing that was doing one of the great Dharma contemplations, who knows? Anyway, a Dharma brother wrapped up in a blanket walks past very slowly. His expressionless gaze fixed intently on the floor in front of him. It occurs to me, this is what a nursing home must be like. There's a few people in soft chairs. It is like a nursing home, isn't it? And that makes me the matron. So, as I told you, this is not just a training for death. Coming to this retreat, you're training to see what it's like in a nursing home. So you're getting used to it while you're still healthy. This is a bit of a nursing home, isn't it? Anyway, very good observation. I like that. Dear Ajahn, is Dutanga practice, is it considered middle way? Definition of nimitta, please. Can't explain. No, time is short. Sorry for two questions. Okay. Dutanga practice. That's some of the practices which people with great defilements have to make use of. Things like for the monks, it's like staying up all night, sometimes wearing only just the three robes, no more robes than that, robes of patches. Now, the thing is that monks think they're so proud because they have to do these Dhyatanga practices. They think, look at me, I do the Dhyatanga practices. But they're there for people who've got excess lust or excess anger. So instead of being proud, they said, oh, you have to do that, that means you've got excess lust. What are you proud of that for? So the middle way, you know, if you're just the average Joe or the average, you know, monk, sort of, they may be useful, but sometimes people, I've seen that monks do this out of like, too much pride, spiritual pride. And they see how many Dhyatanga practices they can do, how austere and ascetic they can be. And they look down upon all those other monks who are not being so austere, not being so ascetic. Oh, I sleep in a cemetery. Where do you sleep? You sleep in a hut, you lazy, no good wimp of a monk. How many robes have you got? I've got much less than that. Sometimes it's that spiritual one-upmanship. So the Dhyatangas are there for a purpose, and it means if you've got a big problem, you really like, say, for a monk, like you like lots of robes, then use old robes. Now, if you're just so lazy, you just like to sleep a lot, then stay up at night. If you're just really afraid of ghosts, then go and stay in a cemetery and find out what real ghosts are like. I keep on telling you, the real ghosts are nice and soft and cuddly. Real ghosts. But the poor things, they got this terrible thing because they're always being rejected. When people come out to see someone, have a nice chat, just to say hello, to pass the time of the day, people go screaming at them, go, ah, a ghost is after me. Imagine what that would do for you. What the sort of complexes ghosts get when nobody likes them. Most ghosts are really depressed because no one likes them. They're so lonely because they can't talk to anybody. And they get this terrible inferiority complex because people keep screaming at them every time. Imagine if people kept on screaming at you every time they met you. You'd be a case for some therapist for years and years and years. So imagine what ghosts feel like. They're really a case for the psychiatrist's chair. So please be kind to ghosts. And I'm going to start a Kind to Ghosts week. We have all these other weeks, a week for breast cancer, a week for domestic violence. I'm having a week for ghosts. Instead of having the World Wildlife Fund, I'm going to start the World Ghost Fund and try to look after the ghosts in the world instead of trying to exorcise them all the time. Poor things. Anyway, Dhyatanga practice. How do you get on to ghosts from Dhyatanga? It's like sometimes you go into the cemeteries. It's only if you're afraid of those things. Because after a while you go to the cemeteries a few times. They're just cemeteries, that's all. Nothing wrong there. So this is what the middle way. It depends on where you are. If you've got a lot of anger or a lot of sort of attachment to clothes, this is just for monks, then you do these practices just to try and balance yourself. If you're leaning over to the left, you have to go to the right. If you're leaning over to the right, you have to lean more to the left. That's all they are. But good monks don't tell you what practices they're doing. They don't show off. They just do them in silence. Definition of nimitta, please kindly explain. The way I use nimitta here, nimitta can mean any, there's many different meanings of nimitta, but the one I use here is this sign of the mind, this reflection of your citta, which appears to everybody as this beautiful light in the mind. Sometimes people see it as white, sometimes as yellow, sometimes as gold, sometimes as blue or purple, all sorts of different colors. Even had one lady once here had a blancmange nimitta, a pink one. And I asked her, I said, what is it? And when she described it, it was a dinky dye nimitta, a real nimitta. That's just how she saw it. But there's one thing I will tell you. The color of the nimitta is completely irrelevant because you all see the same thing. You add the color. The color's not inherent in the experience. You add it. What you expect to see there. That's the fascinating thing about nimittas. So whatever color it is, I don't care. What's important is its brightness, its beauty, and its stability. That's what a nimitta is. Any questions about that? Okay. Brahma Wangso, why? From you know who. And the answer is, why not? Vidyajapra. To the casual observer, we must look like a bunch of overstuffed, creepy Jesuses. We are not, of course, creeping Jesuses. But that's because we're in a Catholic monastery. Actually, that happened to me once. When I used to go down to Bunbury, which is a town about maybe 150 kilometres south of here, to teach at a prison. I was invited to teach there and teach the prisoners. And the only time they had was actually in the evening. And to get down there, I used the train, the public transport. And so the only train actually went just in the morning time and got there just by lunchtime. It took a packed lunch with me. I needed this place to stay and hang out for the afternoon. And the guy who invited me, he knew the Catholic priest in Bunbury. He got permission for me to stay at the parish house. So I actually stayed where the Catholic priests stayed, next to the cathedral. It was really a great time, because I really got to know those guys very well. I was a Buddhist monk, they were Catholics. And, you know, after a while, you know, who are you? And getting to know each other, we became quite good friends, had some great conversations. But the Catholic priests are in that parish house, and one of the things, they're always on call to go out if somebody needed the last rites, if they're about to die. That was one of their duties and jobs. And so one evening, after coming back from the prison, I was chatting to them, and then there was one call, one had to go out, another call, another one had to go out as well. So it left me in this parish house by myself, just a Buddhist monk. And of course, the obvious thing happened. There's another emergency, and someone knocked on the door. And this little old lady was there to want to get a priest, and I opened the door. She looked at me and said, ah! She wondered what I was doing, what a Buddhist monk was doing in the stronghold of the church. So she ran away, and I told the priest afterwards, in case anything was wrong, and they kindly said, look, next time that happens, if you're by yourself, please don't answer the door. Just stay in your room or whatever. Because it was just a bit strange for the poor lady. But that's what happens sometimes. So you may get misjudged as a bunch of Jesuses. But as you recommend continuation of the retreat lifestyle, where practically when we leave here with metta? So, when you leave here, you haven't left yet. You may never leave. So all those questions, just don't take them too seriously. And just see what happens. If you can't find another retreat, fine. There's always another retreat coming up somewhere in the world with some monk or some nun. But the point is that many of you have to go back to work. And you have to do your duties and jobs in the world. And that's me as well. Tomorrow I have to go and teach meditation at Dhammaloka, then go back to the monastery. It's a big ceremony on Sunday. The Thais are having their New Year's ceremonies and ordination in the afternoon. And after that, Ajahn Yana is coming to pick him up from the airport. Oh, I have such a stressful lifestyle. You wouldn't believe it. So, just wait till tomorrow before it happens. Don't think about it until then. So I'll talk tomorrow morning will be how to make use of what you've learned here in your daily life. So maybe I'll just put that question aside until tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock talk. A nice thank you here. Thank you, Jeff and Brett, for taking such good care of us all. Lots of metta from the retreatants of Easter 2005. Jeff and Brett were the organizers of this retreat. The unseen hands, which makes everything run smoothly. The ones who coordinated all the meals. The ones who set this up. The ones who actually take all the money and pay off everybody. So they are the organizers who made this wonderful retreat. So tomorrow they'll come and maybe thank them tomorrow. And thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for taking care of our spiritual needs. Lots of metta from the retreatants of Easter 2005. And for all the other people, the silent helpers behind me, the two monks, sister, and the Anagarika, these are the power source. Sometimes it's the people who say nothing are the wise ones. There's an old saying, he who says doesn't know. And that leaves me in a big pickle. And he who knows doesn't say. So it must be these two guys, Sister and Anagarika. So anyhow. Dear Ajahn. Dear Ajahn, is one of the purposes of monastic training go against our desire and attachment? Please explain. Some of us are new to the Sangha members. May Ajahn introduce us to the Sangha present, and for how long have there been monks, nuns, and Anagarikas? For Ajahn's recruitment drive and campaign, thank you, Ajahn, for a wonderful and fun retreat. Well done with metta. Why do person monastic training go against our desires and attachments? Or, is it tomorrow? No, on Sunday, we're having a novice ordination. And part of the novice ordination, which I really point out to everybody watching, is that when the novice comes up and says, Sabba dukkha nissavana nibbana sachi karana taya, kasawa gehetawa papajang deita me bante. Do you remember that, Sister Seri, when you did your chanting as well? We all did that. What that means is that I ask for the robes to go forth for the purpose, Sabba dukkha nissavana nibbana sachi karana taya, for the purpose of freedom from all suffering, for the sake of nibbana. And that's the tradition when you go forth and enter the Sangha. You make that declaration. And I make sure all the monks remember that for the rest of their life. If I could, I'd tattoo it on their forehead. That you're a monk because to escape from all dukkha and to achieve nibbana. That's the reason why you're a monk. It's not for an easy lifestyle. It's not to go against desire and attachments. That's the path, but the purpose is to end all suffering. So always remember that when you're a monk. To gain nibbana, that one purpose, that one pointedness of your mind. So you keep on going until you achieve that goal. That's why people are monks or nuns. Not just because it's an easy lifestyle. Not because they can sit up and get everyone sort of writing these nice notes to them. Not to become some kind of guru. Just for one reason, and one reason alone, to become enlightened. And the monks, sitting on my left, is Venerable Santuti. How long have you been in robes now? You've been novice for 1 year? Couple of months ago, and many of you remember him from, was it 2 years ago or 3 years ago, when he was a cook on the retreat here, very famous for his cookery. And on my right is Venerable Satyamanta. How long have you been a monk now? 3 years as a monk. He used to be a lawyer in, where was it?
New Mexico.
So, see, lawyers is a lot of suffering. But they're being a monk. And Sister Sari, how long have you been a nun now? Almost a year. Almost a year. There we go. And Sui Ping, you've been an Anagarika for a long time. You're just trying to get a visa. When are you going to become a nun in Brown? Do you know yet? Don't know yet. Could be any time soon. Who knows? So that's the Sangha members here today. And Santuti. Anyone know what Santuti means? Has it got anything to do with tutti frutti? No. Santuti means contentment. That's why it just sits there so content. And Satimanto means one who's endowed with mindfulness. That's why he's so mindful. And Seri, Sister Seri, means the free one, the liberated one. Seri means freedom. Isn't that nice names we get? Dear Ajahn Brahm, it's already the last night. It looks like it is not easy to go to Nibbana. Can you show the way to the Deva realm instead? No. You get to Nibbana or nothing. At this time, for you desperate ones, You tell the story of, was it Sister Siha? I think it was Siha, wasn't it? She was the one who hadn't just done like a 9-day retreat. That's easy. She'd become a nun. And she stayed a nun for 7 years. And with all those years of being a nun, never once did she get any peace in her meditation. Now imagine what that's like, you've just been here for 9 days. Most of you got some peace. This poor nun never once got any peace for 7 years. So at the end of 7 years, she thought, it's a waste of time. And she didn't want to go back to the world again and have to cook for her husband. It's why that she, in the verses of the enlightened nuns, they gave all these wonderful poems. And they always talk about having given up the three crooked things. The three crooked things was like a metaphor which the bhikkhunis used, actually, to say about giving up, you know, their previous lives. And the first crooked thing which the nun gives up is the broom. It symbolizes giving up housework, you know, the broom to sweep. So that's the first crooked thing I've given up, you know, the broom. The second crooked thing they gave up was the ladle, signified cookery. They didn't have to cook anymore, now they're nuns. The second thing they given up, the second crooked thing was the ladle. And the third crooked thing they gave up, the husband. Those are the three crooked things. The broom, the ladle, and the husband. And so, Sister Siha, the nun, did not want to go back to the three crooked things. But she had no peace living as a nun. So there's only one thing for her to do. She took a length of rope. She went into the forest. She tied one end of the rope to a branch of a tree. She tied the other one, end of the rope, to her neck. She was about to jump off. At that moment, she became enlightened. That was cutting it fine. Not to be recommended. Don't you try that. But, just the last moment, she managed to get enlightened. You know why? She gave up. That's why she became enlightened. She'd been struggling all those years, and then she stopped and gave up. That's why she became enlightened. I think I mentioned it in Nolamara recently, the simile of the donkey and enlightenment. Do you all know the simile of the donkey and enlightenment? How many people don't know that simile? Put your hand up. No, it's enough to tell it. This is another original Ajahn Brahm simile about enlightenment. You may have gone to Southern Europe, or you may have seen documentaries, but in that part of the world until recently, the main form of transport was donkey carts. They would tie a donkey to a cart. But to get the donkey to move was not easy, because donkeys are notoriously stubborn. You can hit them, and they still won't pull that cart. So the only way you can get the donkey to move is you have to tie a stick to the donkey's back, which protrudes about 2 feet in front of the donkey's head. On the end of that stick, you tie a string. And on the other end of the string, you tie a carrot. And this donkey is standing there and sees this nice juicy carrot about 2 feet in front of it. So of course, the donkey wants to eat the carrot and moves closer to eat it. In so doing, he pulls the string, which pulls the cart, which makes the carrot go even further in front of him. So no matter how much the donkey moves, the carrot's always just in front. And that's the way they get these donkeys to pull the carts. But my observation has been that you don't see donkey carts in Southern Europe anymore. And they all had to stop using the donkey cart once Buddhism came to Europe. Because once the Dharma became heard amongst the people and spread amongst the donkeys all found out how to catch the carrot. And this is how the donkeys catch the carrot. And it's a metaphor for how people become enlightened. That donkey has been running after that carrot all its life. It's always about 2 feet in front. Just like you have been running after jhana for the last 9 days. Sometimes it's close, but you never quite get it. The more you try, the more it's in front of you. That's what it's like sometimes. But this donkey heard the Buddha's teachings, understands what to do. What that donkey does, it runs like hell after that carrot, as fast as it's ever gone before. And of course, that carrot just runs the same speed in front of the donkey. But this donkey knows the Dhamma. He knows how to let go and stop. So the donkey just stops. Let go, let go, let go. And as soon as the donkey stops, that carrot swings further away than it's ever swung before. Just like when many of you, through letting go, the mind can sometimes go crazy. Think about all sorts of stupid things. But the donkey is smart. It's patient. You don't interrupt the process. You don't do anything. If the donkey does something, he'll miss the carrot. Or the donkey just stands there. And the carrot goes further and further away until it goes to the extreme of awareness. In the same way that when you let go, sometimes you think, I'm further away from peace and happiness than I've ever been before. But there comes a point where the carrot starts swinging back to the donkey. You're doing nothing, and the meditation starts to work. Hey, it's getting peaceful, it's getting nice. And you get to your normal stage of meditation, but this time, that carrot is coming towards the donkey at great speed. You don't have to do anything. Your meditation starts to take off. And these nimittas and jhanas, they just come to you. You just sit there, or stand there in case of the donkey. And just at the right moment, the carrot gets so close that all the donkey needs to remember is, the door of my mouth is open to you. Opens his mouth and closes it again. That's all it needs. That's all you need to do. When the nimitta comes up, the door of my heart's open to you. Jhana comes up, door of my heart's open to you. Enlightenment comes up, door of my heart's open to you. And that's how the donkey catches the carrot. And that's how you become enlightened. You've already strove enough. You've already run hard enough. Now just let go. And stop. Stand. Don't do anything. If that donkey starts to move, the whole thing just doesn't work anymore. It needs to stand absolutely still. And have confidence and faith. You might feel going crazy. Cats all over the place. Enlightenment is just so far away from you. Just sit here. Do nothing. And enlightenment comes to you. That's how you catch enlightenment. Story of the donkey. So those of you who sort of think you haven't got nirvana yet, be careful. Just stop. You've been running so hard all your life, for many lives. Once you stop, the carrot comes to you. Guru-Arjan, in the morning we decide whether or not to get up. Is it true that if one gets up vigorously, it's good karma? And bad karma if one's slothful or grudgingly, please comment. Sure is. When you get up vigorously, you jump out of bed, say, zippity-doo-dah, another day on retreat, yeah! You wake everybody else up, especially if it's 2 o'clock. So do it sort of gently, because you don't want to upset other people. You wake up and, zippity-doo-dah, great, lovely day. Out of compassion for the people in the next room. And you find if you put energy, when you first get up in the morning, you have energy for all the day. You've got to get up anyway, so you might as well get it over and done with. It's a waste of time just putting it off. You just wake up in bed, I've got to get up, well, but not now. And just, you know, putting off, you know, it's like suffering. You have fear for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, fear of getting up. So just do it and get it over and done with. And when you get up with energy that way, you have energy. And you do feel much better. You do have good karma. So just get up. And don't look at the clock until after you've got up. Otherwise, you look it up before you get up, it's always time for another few minutes. Even if it's 5 to 7, still got another 3 minutes before breakfast. Don't look at the clock until later. So it is good karma, getting up vigorously. Next question. Ajahn, when a person attains arahatship, is their superpower consciousness a burden to them? When they enter parinibbana, with all types of consciousness cease without remaining? Now that's a very deep question. And actually the person who wrote that, I'm not sure, but they understand a lot. Because, yeah, even superpower mindfulness for the arahat is regarded as suffering. It's the best they can possibly have in the world. But when it all ceases, it's even better. This is a strange thing. When you understand jhana, you'll understand why this is the case. Why it's sometimes, just for fun, to see how much monks understand of Dhamma, I ask them, does an arahat, an enlightened being, experience suffering? Or are they free from suffering? What do you think? Is an enlightened being experience suffering, or are they free from suffering once they're enlightened? The answer is, they experience suffering. An enlightened being suffers. Think, wow, what's the point of being enlightened if you still have suffering? The point of being is, the enlightened being, the arahat, has destroyed the causes of suffering. Which is rebirth, having another body, having to go through this all over again. Everything, every sensory experience, compared to the end of sensory experience, is seen as actually suffering. But the arahat knows, their joy is that, you know, that when this five khandhas, this body of mind, come to their end in this life, what we call death, they know that's the end. There is no more birth. There's no more suffering. It's at parinibbana that suffering ends. Parinibbana means the complete nibbana, when the arahat passes away. That's why when I was taking the pilgrimage to India recently, I told some of the people on pilgrimage that Kusinara, to me, was the most important place. Not where the Buddha became enlightened, not where he taught the Dhamma, certainly not where he was born. But this is where he came to the culmination of all of his wisdom, striving, all of his attainment. Where he entered Parinibbana, ceased from existence. That was the most powerful thing. That was actually an interesting observation, because people had to ask, what are you talking about? In the Theragata and Therigata, the verses of the arahats from the time of the Buddha, people explain what it's like to be enlightened. They say it's like a workman waiting for their wages, waiting for the big paycheck. They've done their job. They've finished their work. They haven't got the paycheck yet. That was the arahat. They'd cut the course of rebirth, destroyed it. Now they had to wait until the cause brought out its result of Parinibbana. So, whoever asked that question, great question, the deepest one we've had so far, when a person attains arahatship, is their superpower consciousness a burden to them? Yes, it is. When they attain Parinibbana, will all types of consciousness cease without remaining? Yes. And with it, all suffering ceasing forever. Any questions about that? You'd only understand that answer if you get the deep stages of meditation and understand what cessation is. It's like a person leaving prison. If you haven't left prison yet, always been in prison, you can't understand what prison is like. Dear Ajahn, I am so grateful to you and members of the Buddhist Society for organizing and managing this retreat. You have all given so generously your precious time for the happiness of others. Thank you very much. Also, a big thank you to those who have offered generous, delicious lunches every day. This is really what I call heaven on earth. Doing nothing, nice place to stay and relax, good food to eat, and as Aussies we say, no worries, mate. And best of all, listening to your inspiring Dhamma talks and answer to our questions every day. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It doesn't get better than this. And if you think it does, you have a great disappointment. Why are you planning what you're going to do next when you're in heaven right now? You ever notice that? Sometimes when you're in heaven, you waste the opportunities and the time.